Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind, a continuing series of conversations about the cultures of consciousness. A couple of years ago, after the death of Steve Jobs, I was asked to do a public talk about Jobs and his relationship to religion and spirituality, because as a student of American religion and its connections with media technology and popular culture, the death of Steve Jobs was a fascinating moment. It was very clear that there was this outpouring of concern and praise and a sort of emotional explosion, really, throughout the culture, that had this character of something deeper than just the acknowledgement of a titan of industry going into that dark night. Instead, you had a window there of seeing the sort of ritualistic and even religious ways that people felt about their technology. It went far beyond the sort of element of the sacred that runs through celebrity culture, where celebrities sort of become the saints or the gods that people are fascinated by and will leave, you know, piles of flowers when they pass. But this was something deeper, because it's rare for a CEO of a major corporation to die and receive that kind of adulation, the kind of thing you get with sports stars or Princess Diana or rock and roll figures. Instead, it's this captain of industry. And that said something really deeply about the role of media technology in our lives, of computer technology, of this whole world of social devices and gadgetry that now kind of constitute our social reality in so many ways. And it particularly said something about Apple, that whether or not one is an Apple user, the ethos, the feeling, the design, the vision, the mythology of Apple products, and sort of typified by this figure Steve Jobs, really gets down to some basic values that people have that are often more religious or ethical or spiritual or supernatural even than people tend to acknowledge. We're not aware to quite the degree to which we are engaging with a myth when we're engaging with our machines. But at this moment, you could sort of see into this sort of hidden underbelly of the myth of Mac. And I'm really happy today we're going to be speaking with Brett Robinson, who just came out with a book called Appletopia, Media Technology and the Religious Imagination of Steve Jobs. And Brett is a professor of marketing at the Mendoza College of Business at Notre Dame. And so this is going to be a very interesting conversation, because not only is the story about marketing, how Apple continues to draw from very core elements of the ethos of the counterculture, of the spiritual but not religious worldview, even of certain kinds of Buddhist ideas in their fashioning of devices, and then they're creating a whole sort of lifestyle around the use of digital technology. But Steve Jobs himself has, of course, a very interesting religious biography. At certain points in his life, Hinduism, psychedelics, and especially Zen Buddhism played a very important role in shaping his aesthetic, shaping his sense of how computers could function in people's lives. So what looks at the surface like the story of the triumph of information capitalism is also in some ways a story of the triumph of a certain sensibility, of a kind of California mixture of personal technology and spiritual technique. So I think it's going to be a really interesting conversation. Before we bring Brett on, of course, we have our co-host here in Expanding Mind, the lovely Maja Daou. Maja, welcome to the show.
Hi, Eric. How's it going?
Good, good. Hey, have you always been a user of Apple products, or were you? I know you have one now, but
I do. You know, it's genetic for me. My mother was the third person in the city of Seattle to get that new Mac when it came out. There had been like the Apple IIe's, which I had as a kid. We would play Zork on the Apple IIe because we got one from my uncle. And then my mom was a graphic designer. She was like a freelance graphic designer. I can't remember the model of Mac, but it was like the first Mac that had like, you know, the freestanding monitor and like from like set apart from those Apple IIe's and Commodore 64's and like all those kind of computers. And she was like one of the first ones in the city to get the darn thing. So I remember so vividly as a kid her like adventures through Macintosh, and with like all the, it would bomb all the time and like, you know, go through all this stuff. But because of my mother's use of it, like that was just the computers that we had. So for me, I felt more comfortable using them.
Yeah, that's so funny because just right off the bat, it tells you something about Apple that even earlier in their career, they were something that would be interested to a graphic designer, to someone who wasn't just working with computer code or statistics or scientific readings, the kinds of things that computers had been associated with in the era of
yep.
mainframes. And that already talks about the way that Apple was shaping itself to kind of get inside the aesthetics of our lives as well as
yeah.
the sort of rational operation. But I'm just like you. The Mac was always my machine. I mean, I did a little bit of programming in the early 80s, but that was my first device in the mid 80s, and I just sort of, I'm signed up. But now I'm a sort of grumpy, you know, like in any cult or religion, like the dudes who've been around for a couple of decades, they're always grumpy, and there's all this
yep.
sniping, and it's like the new management, it's all going downhill back in the day, but, you know, that's sort of what it's like to be a cult member as well. So with that, let's bring Brett onto the show. Brett, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Hi, Eric Umaja. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you teach marketing and its relationship to culture and psychology. And so, I mean, that's one place to start because, as I mentioned, I think it's one of the interesting things about Apple is that it's very layered. Like, you can talk about marketing campaigns as a way to understand how they're consciously developing a kind of mythology of the self and a sort of strategy of a lifestyle that's being presented. And, you know, that's one level. But then there's all these other levels, too, about Steve Jobs and the history of the company in California. And there's just lots of interesting ways in which religion and technology get woven together. So I'm curious, out of all these different dimensions, what was the thing that sort of caught your interest at first, where you started to go, hey, there's a deeper project here. There's something that I want to do. But what element of it was really stood out for you?
Well, it started with, as you say, kind of a more general interest in the connections between technology and spirituality. And I think even beyond that, the idea that communication itself has a certain metaphysical transcendent quality to it when we try to understand it at its deepest level. So someone like John Durham Peters, who wrote Speaking Into the Air and really highlighted these connections between the traditions of communication and the ways in which communication informed spirituality, really got me started thinking about these things. And then, Eric, it was your book, Technosis, that made it crystallize for me. And it was around the same time that I was looking at Apple ads for a project I was working on in graduate school. So, and I'm not saying this out of some false humility, but I think Appletopia is truly a footnote to Technosis. It's truly an illustration, I think, or I hope, of what you were trying to convey in that book. So those were kind of the strands that came together at that time about 4 years ago when I started writing it.
Well, that's very sweet to hear, and it was actually really exciting for me because, as I said, I hadn't done too much on Apple per se in that book, and it was actually only recently after the death of Steve Jobs that I kind of went back into it and looked more closely and started putting pieces together, but I never really wrote about it. It was just kind of lying around, and then there's just so much stuff, plus a lot of things I didn't know that you pulled out in the book, and it's So there's a lot of exciting places to go. I thought maybe we'd start with just one. Which of the ad campaigns, and not even just the ad campaigns, but even the sort of intentionality of the design that went into their products, but of all the products or the campaigns, which is the one that seems to you to best express on the level of marketing, on the level of the image that they're intentionally creating, the ways in which Apple have creatively gone into a sort of spiritual dimension or an element of ethos in the culture, and really try to sort of say what they were, show how they were doing something different that was tapping a kind of deeper source of value.
Yeah, well, I start with the logo. It's an easy one. It's a low-hanging fruit, no pun intended, but it's a piece of fruit with a bite removed, right? So there's that temptation, again, no pun intended, to suggest that, hey, this is the forbidden fruit. We've taken a bite of it. In the biblical story, of course, it leads to the fall of man. But in the Gnostic story, it's actually the reverse, right? It's man reclaiming that divine knowledge or gnosis, and so it's seen as a form of liberation. And so one could, if one studied English in undergraduate as I did, read these things into things as simple as the logo itself. But then as I went further and looked at more of what I call the iconography of Apple and the mythology of technology, you look at something like the 1984 television spot for the Super Bowl that became this iconic ad and really launched the era of big budget cinematic type Super Bowl spots. In the ad, it's a Orwellian dystopian view of this techno culture where everyone's sort of slaves to what's implied to be IBM. And it's the Macintosh heroine that comes in and smashes this illusion and liberates the masses from this enslavement that becomes the hero. And so immediately you have this very kind of explicit mythological treatment of technology at a time in 1984 when there were a lot of cultural anxieties around technology. I mean, computers were associated with the Cold War and the space program and these very detached and sometimes nefarious purposes. So the idea that every home should have a personal computer was still somewhat foreign and a little bit scary to many people. So Apple, the genius there was they were able to mythologize that, which is really the purpose of myth, you know, is to kind of take this big thing that we don't understand fully and try to distill it into a form that of a story that makes it more approachable, and sold the idea that personal computers could be these liberating, creative, expressive tools. And what made Apple so successful over the years is they never really deviated from that storyline. It took different forms and manifested itself in different ways over the course of the promotional campaigns, but there was always that sense that this was the alternative to the kind of enslaved technocratic society, which is ironic given that they're selling technology, and Jobs himself is kind of the anti-corporate hero. I mean, he's a billionaire, but he's still appeals to the counterculture, and so there's all these paradoxes.
Well, that's precisely. I mean, reading through your book and also coming to appreciate your own, you know, somewhat sour take on the consequences of this utopian myth or this sort of, you know, rhetoric of the humanism of the dominance of these technologies in our lives, that the paradoxes just go all the way through, you know, and it's almost challenging you to think your way out of the paradox, to resolve it. And that's part of the point. You, towards the end, you talk about how a lot of the slogans of Apple are themselves actually paradoxes. So the paradoxes that we experience in technology, that on the one hand, there's a liberating dimension or there's a liberating story around it, and personally in our lives it can be very liberating and bring us into new possibilities, and at the same time every step of the way we're just, you know, weaving ourselves ever more deeply into a kind of network of surveillance and control and big data, and so it's like there's a paradox. And Steve Jobs himself, you know, a saint, a devil, you know, like the sort of classic, like there's no greater, with the exception of Larry Ellison, there's no better image of the kind of techno CEO asshole. And at the same time, people feel about this guy like he's some kind of spiritual visionary who somehow crafted something that touches the depths of the human spirit. And it's like, how do you reconcile these images? I mean, even as a CEO, the guy, he never gave any money to anybody. I mean, he was a real jerk in a lot of ways, and yet there was this sense of adulation around him, which was really, it's just, the paradoxes go all the way through.
Well, and just to add into, you know, in addition to that, Eric, at the time, back in the day, I was on a lot of chat rooms, and I knew a lot of the hackers that were involved with this site called the Cult of the Dead Cow. And a lot of them saw Apple as, like you said, it was like a control mechanism because it didn't use code, and they felt like it actually gave less control and not this kind of liberating thing like he was trying to present, but rather that it was this tyranny because people would lose the ability to code and understand computers by using Macs because they would be, you know, a little lazier because it was all done for them. So it's funny, like that, you know, feeds into what you were saying.
So where does this paradoxicality come from, Brett?
Well, I think there's two things to point out. One is that when one tries to make a claim like this, that Apple has this religious resonance, that in one sense the paradox is what gives it that resonance. If you think about religion, it's filled, and that's Buddhism, that's Christianity, Hinduism. That paradox really is at the heart of many of these belief systems, and that's what makes them so fascinating and so hard to pin down. So there's that element, which I don't know was a sort of conscious idea on Jobs' part. What was conscious on Jobs' part was his formation in the humanities and the liberal arts in the Eastern spiritual traditions in his early years. And in particular, a course he took at Reed College after he had dropped out, he still took courses, and one of the courses was on William Blake's poetry, and the professor had, I think, a profound impact on Jobs. He was very interested in Buddhism, and Blake himself, William Blake, the Romantic poet, was interested in Buddhism, one of the first translators of Buddhist texts. And his poetry was filled with paradox. The Marriage of Heaven and Hell is the classic kind of example, that he saw heaven not as sort of the place of the good and hell the place of evil, but both were expressions of human kind of impulses and desires, and together, kind of in harmony, they formed the entirety of reality. And so there was this notion that there was this poetic idea that we could resolve the paradox or create experiences that the yin and the yang are brought together. And I think Jobs tried to express that creatively through the advertising, through the product design, that these two worlds could coexist. And as you mentioned, some of the slogans, for some of the products I mentioned in the last, you know, chapter, the iPod Shuffle, random is the new order, the PowerBook, less is more, touching is believing for the iPhone. So these kind of contradictory ideas being brought together rhetorically. But then, as you say, and as Maja says, all these other levels in which technology attracts kind of the paradoxical thinking. And one of the other influences I should mention that got this project started was Umberto Eco's famous essay on Mac being Catholic and DOS being Protestant. And I think it speaks to what Maja was talking about. Eco was a semiotician, looked at semiotic signs, symbols for meaning, and he kind of tongue-in-cheek looked at Mac and Apple as Catholic because it was full of icons, this lush iconography, and you didn't have to really understand computers to understand how to use a Mac, just like a medieval illiterate could understand the Catholic faith just by walking into a cathedral and being surrounded by its imagery and the music and so forth. Whereas DOS or Windows later had a more kind of a Protestant idea that you had to understand the text and you had to understand the code. And so I love that you point that out, that, you know, that Apple was obscuring the code in a way that, you know, that there's a certain There's something really fascinating about that.
That's a really good comparison, actually, to compare it to the Catholic Church, because it's kind of true. They take away the understanding and discipline, right, and then just make it easily accessible.
And it's,
right.
It's really important to, you know, highlight just how radical that shift is, and then how much the sort of the Apple Catholic model won in a lot of ways. I mean, in that, you know, eventually later iterations of Windows and indeed all the devices we have now are so increasingly icon-driven. People are scared of terminal windows. People don't want to look at a command line. And even the devices themselves are becoming increasingly less text-based. So the whole move away from code, linearity, textuality in our interaction with computers is, you know, it's a massive, massive shift. And then if we remember the way that the Protestant would see it, you know, in this language, or the cult of the dead cow, where you're like, look, every step we take away from understanding how these machines are actually operating beneath the surface, every step we take away from that, we're disempowering ourselves, however much it looks like we're actually being empowered to do X and Y. And there's another paradox that lies at the heart of Apple, is that on some level, Apple's saying, trust us, we're able to design an experience that maximizes you and what you want and what you want to create, but we do that partly by not giving you the maps and the tools to deal with what goes on behind the curtain.
Right, and there's, you see these movements now, for especially in early education. Now they're online programs trying to get children to and adults to learn to code. I mean, there's these very engaging kind of online tutorials, and people like Douglas Rushkoff, who are really advocating, being an advocate for learning how to program, because I think rightly so, there's a concern and anxiety that, you know, we're kind of, culture's kind of bifurcating into these two camps where you have the programmers and then the programmed, right? So if you don't know how culture is being programmed at the code level, then how much input do you really have? As you say, you have this sort of false sense of creativity and empowerment and participation because you're able to click the icon or play the game. But what's going on behind that? And I think metaphorically speaking, the addiction to these devices in general is a certain type of cultural programming, you know, that social patterns, cultural patterns are changing as a result of our this constant, pervasive, persistent use of these devices.
And again, just to keep up on the paradoxes, I was going down, you know, driving in the, I live in the Bay Area, so I get, there's a lot of advertisement that's very, you know, tech and Bay Area spirituality mixed together, and you see it relatively regularly. And there was an ad for some new information backup service that used Zen. So you saw, you know, there was the Zen word, and it had this sort of Japanese traditional background. And it's so ironic that if you think of, you know, what's one of the things you associate, what kind of consciousness, what kind of mind do we associate with Zen, with sitting, with quiet, with contemplation, with open spaces, with, you know, this very slow sense of duration, with the no more activity than a single bird flying in the distance. And yet the reality of our engagement with technology is just this constant cutting, of slicing, of shifting frames, of being, you know, dosed by these little blasts of data or incoming information, that it's like you can't imagine a bigger engine for the monkey mind in meditation terms. So we can see the way that the sort of dreams of the Buddhist meditator or of the yogi, you know, and yoga is so big in the same kind of world, you can see the way it's trying to balance out a much more problematic, potentially addictive, certainly distracting, certainly scrambling kinds of effects of what these machines actually do on in the fabric of our ordinary lives.
Yeah, and you have these conferences out there, too, that are getting fairly mature now, like the Wisdom 2.0 conference, where they teach mindfulness to to tech people, tech executives, people that work in tech. And then there's, and I mentioned in the book, the Waldorf School in the Bay Area, where sons and daughters of Google and Yahoo and Apple execs are going to a school with no computers. So there's an awareness even among those creating the products and these objects of desire that that there needs to be an antidote to this torrent. And you know, I think Jobs, in the Jobs mythology, in the Jobs version of the story, the intuitiveness and the simplicity of the products themselves was maybe supposed to be a built-in kind of antidote to what would eventually become kind of this unintended consequence of distraction and addiction and all the things that seem to contradict those ideas, those Zen ideas that you describe so well. So, you know, one of the ironclad rule of technology is that there are these unintended consequences, and that's kind of what we're living with. And this Apple story is just such a fascinating chapter in this development. I think, as you say, as members of the cult, you kind of get disenfranchised, disenchanted. The CEO is not as charismatic anymore. There's this whole notion of being walled off from how the things work, and now there's plenty of alternatives and other companies that are competing with Apple. But the story's kind of set. I mean, we're kind of on this path now, and so the book is kind of a call to retain or maintain some interpretive dignity and integrity, and to think through these things.
Yeah, one question, I mean, there's a couple of things that come to mind, but one thing I wanted to ask you about Jobs, and this is something like I got from your book that I hadn't really thought about myself or quite read, at least to that degree, in the other accounts of Apple, is that some of the appeal of Apple products, their sense of the intuitive, their playfulness, the graphic richness, came not just out of his interest as a designer, so that he approached the computer environment rather than as a boring nerd, as he was also a designer, a graphic designer who cared about design, and that this experience that he and the characters that he corralled were creating was a more multidimensional aesthetic experience. But you point towards the idea that some of that was very consciously done in terms of his own view of the role of intuition and the power of intuition over and against kind of mere rationality or mere reason. Can you talk a little bit about that, like where he got these ideas and in what way you can see in the design of the technologies some of this attention to the intuitive side of things?
Right, so when he, as a young man, went to India and did his pilgrimage, he noticed among the he was looking to talk to gurus and to really explore this interest that he had in Eastern spirituality. But he found, even talking to the Hindu villagers, the illiterate villagers, that they had a different way of thinking. They literally had a different structure of thought for approaching the world, and it was, to him, it was much more intuitive than the Western mind, which after this experience, he saw the Western mind as deranged. And if you read people like Marshall McLuhan and some of the media ecology people that really see media technologies as being formative kind of elements in human consciousness and structures of thought, that this would make sense in a sense, Jobs' analogy here, because the Western mind was reared on print, and print is very much a linear kind of logical progression of ideas. And so whatever the dominant media technology is of a particular culture, the individuals in that culture tend to take on its form in their patterns and structures of thinking. And so I think Jobs, coming from the linear, rational, print-based West, runs into this basically non-technological culture where it's very much more, intuitive. And I think, again, in that spirit of the paradox, he thought, you know, one of the inspirations might be that I can as a designer and as someone who understands computers, I could resolve this. I could create a machine or a series of devices that break that kind of linear rational mindset and insert this intuitive sensibility. And I don't think that was meant to just completely get rid of or disregard rationality, but it was to find this balance that the yogis and the gurus speak of between intuition and rationality, kind of reasoned intuition, as it were. And so the computer became an expression of that. So, and that's why I think it's fair to say, Jobs was an artist in the sense, not just that he understood aesthetics and design, but that he understood that the things he was producing, physical objects, technologies, were expressions of these bigger ideas.
Yeah, and it's really interesting also to that way in which when we're engaged these things, we're kind of participating in somebody else's experiment.
we're not always sure
what the experimental protocols are, and that I think a lot of people who are attracted to Apple products precisely for the elements that he was intentionally bringing forward, they're not experiencing it necessarily as this sort of shift in values, shift in fundamental values on that almost philosophical level. And yet the results are there. I think that they manifest in people's lives and in cultural sensibility and shifts in cultural sensibility. So it's really quite remarkable. Anyway, there's a lot more questions to ask for, but we've got to take a break here on Expanding Mind. You're listening to Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Brett Robinson about Appletopia, media technology, and the religious imagination of Steve Jobs, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Minds on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou here with Eric Davis. We're speaking with Brett Robinson. We're talking about computers and Apple and religion and how some spiritual ideas can infiltrate technology. And I wanted to ask you, along some of those same lines, we've been having the conversation about how Apple was able to, through its media and, PR and stuff like that, present these paradoxes to try to trigger that response. And then there was also the imagination of Steve Jobs himself. But I wanted to, if you could, maybe compare that to Bill Gates, because I grew up in Seattle, and I knew a lot of people that worked at Microsoft. I've been to the Microsoft facility, been in there, and funnily enough, all the people I knew, which is a handful, it's not a lot, but all the people I knew that worked at Microsoft actually had Apple computers, which is pretty hilarious. And I was wondering if you could say, where do you think Steve Jobs' imagination in terms of the Appleness, how did that differ from Bill Gates? What did Bill Gates do, wrong, so to speak, or what boat did he miss? That it just kind of was so different.
Yeah, I think, the more, even after I wrote the book, I kept thinking through this and the questions like that, what trying to get to the kernel of what was so unique. And I still think it goes back to art. And I think it goes back to the notion that particularly in a more secularized culture, that art serves a religious function or purpose. And Jobs was not shy about incorporating in whatever way he could, metaphorically, explicitly, implicitly, these poetic ideas, these artistic ideas, these aesthetic ideas into computers, which was not necessarily a natural fit at the start. I mean, like you said, you start with command line and green letters on a black screen, and when he launched the Macintosh in the auditorium in California and showed the early kind of paint program with his photo in it and showed how you can manipulate images. This drew the biggest reaction from the crowd because there was this notion that that's not what computers do. Computers calculate.
Right.
It worked with
my mom. Like I said, my mom was an artist. She bought it hook, line, and sinker, man.
Right. Yeah, and there's a story in the book about when he's visiting John Lennon's son after John Lennon had passed away, and Andy Warhol's there, in this Manhattan apartment, and he brings Sean Lennon a new Macintosh for his birthday. And Andy Warhol, the famed American pop artist, comes into the room, and he sees it, and he wants to play with it. And it's just the paint program, again, very rudimentary, basic. But he's blown away. I mean, they can't tear him away from the computer. And I talk about this story as kind of a passing of the torch in American popular art, in the sense that Warhol kind of broke open the door of combining consumerism with artistic sensibilities. And then here comes Jobs with a really sexy technology that does the same thing. And then he's off and running. And so that's where Gates, you know, Gates was brilliant and Microsoft's very successful. But they were a bit, saw themselves as a business machine. I mean, that dichotomy is finally kind of fading, you know, that Windows and Microsoft are for doing business and accounting and spreadsheets, and Apple's for doing art and movies and that sort of thing. Now both are kind of cross-pollinating. But as a marketer, that was not necessarily a bad move for Gates. I mean, to say, all right, you want the art, you know, artsy crowd, I'll do the business, because that's going to be a much, I'm going to get more market share out of that anyway.
Well, it's also interesting if you compare the two CEOs, and, you know, I think anyone who spends very much time studying religion has to grapple with another paradox, if you will, that people who are profoundly creative on a religious or spiritual level are not always the most moral people, and vice versa. And what's sort of interesting about this story is that clearly, you know, Jobs is the hero, the artist entrepreneur, the inventor of a whole, you know, of actual new categories of products, the transformer of lifestyles, and then you have the sort of more plodding Bill Gates, who's more dry, more left brain, and, you know, cranking it out for the business community, et cetera, et cetera. And that, okay, whatever else you might want to say about these guys, you know, Gates is devoted himself on a lot of levels with his, you know, admittedly enormous largesse to, you know, to solving some real serious problems in the world. And the dude has done some good. I mean, whatever quibbles you might have about the Gates Foundation and the politics of AIDS in Africa, blah, 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 the guy's done a lot of good. And Jobs, for all his trips to Tassajara to meditate, for all his love of, you know, Yogananda's books on the book, The Autobiography of a Yogi, the guy, like, was a skinflint. He didn't give anybody, he didn't do hardly any work to support people in through philanthropy, through setting up foundations, through any of that, because I think he felt that, like, what the way he was changing the world was through these products, but it clearly didn't lead towards at least some of the ways we think about a more, you know, full-bodied moral life of compassion and service. And that's another weird paradox. That from this perspective, in some ways, Gates looks like a good guy, you know, the good guy, even in that kind of stereotypic battle.
But Jobs banned porn from Apple devices, so that's his moral contribution to that's a joke,
that's
by the way.
True.
Even though he did do that. But that's really interesting. I love that you said that, because there's a ad in the book for the iPhone, the Touching is Believing ad that launched the iPhone, that's a play on Caravaggio's painting of Doubting Thomas. It's a finger in the ad reaching out to touch the iPhone touchscreen interface, which was new at the time, and the tagline is "Touching is believing," and it's a reference to kind of a parody of this Caravaggio painting, this Christian iconography of the doubting apostle Thomas touching the wounds of Christ to believe that he truly resurrected. Touching is believing. Caravaggio was one of these figures. He was he murdered somebody over a tennis bet. And there are all sorts of rumors and innuendo about him, and yet he produces this art and this style that becomes kind of the industry standard, as it were, at that time. And so he becomes the arbiter of cultural taste, even though he has this kind of poor moral kind of stature. And so that's a great point, this kind of paradox, that those that are sometimes less moral get all this sort of religious attention.
I wanted to ask you another question about this on a bigger level, you know, and partly to you as a teacher, dealing with students, with younger people who are coming in, who are grown up even more thoroughly saturated with technology than you or I, and one of the things you're trying to do in your book is to just, you know, develop some critical self-awareness about the stories, the mythologies, the concepts that kind of attempt to organize our experience of technology and our sense of values as we make decisions and as we narrate our lives through these devices. Because, of course, you know, there's a lot of problems to have with the situation, particularly now. I think that the irony that's in the paradox is much more intense now, at least for people paying attention, because if you just take the Internet, if you take the sort of seeming freedom of the Internet as we move between sites and are able to access information without any seeming cost, and we can buy products, and we can meet people and organize our social lives and share information and all this wonderful sort of seeming wonderland of free data and social exchange, when of course we also know that all those moves we make are being recorded and used to create ever more specific profiles, not just of us as statistical actors, but actually as individuals who can be tracked and can be fed back information that sort of encourages our own addictive relationship or our own sort of magnification of desire. That's one way of looking at it. So anyway, it's a very weird situation that, to my mind, really requires critical thinking. And I'm just curious from you, as you, especially dealing with younger students, people who've grown up in this, do you find that it's more difficult to encourage critical thinking about these intimate technologies than you would hope? Is this something you actually feel good about? How do you see the ability to create just even a space of questioning around these things? How do you feel that is now?
That's a great question, and it's so generationally driven. You know, the students I have now are about 20 years old, and I'm almost 40, so I had the benefit of living through a television era and then being mature enough to see the dynamics of transformation as the Internet era took root. They don't have that sense, and that in itself creates a certain divide in our ability to communicate and critique. And so I try to, I take the traditional route, and I have them read books like Appletopia. That's a no-brainer for some royalties, but also it's Neil Postman, Amusing Ourselves to Death, and really try to get them to start having that conversation. And I notice, at least so far, that it doesn't go quite far enough. And I think part of that is that I teach in a business school. I think it would be different if I taught in the Arts and Letters program, or taught, among students that were doing a, liberal studies type of degree where they're reading great books and really already kind of loosening their attachment to some of those things. But business students have to be tied to these things and have to be champions of these things in order to be successful in business. And so that's a challenge for me personally, and a paradox for me as someone who advocates for this critical self-awareness, that I teach a course on social media. So what do you say to a group of people that are training to be, again, champions and advocates of a culture in which everything is tracked and conversations online are used by marketers for all sorts of purposes. So I lost.
Well, what do you think about, let's talk about that for a second in terms of the religious aspect. So, like, God, theoretically, watches everything, and we're held accountable for all of our actions through our consciousness. That's my kind of idea of karma. So here, even though, right, it's like people or the NSA or, these organizations are kind of like, in a weird way, fulfilling that role of the big, the Eye of Providence. In fact, if you type eyeofprovidence.com, it takes you to Google. It's like, what do you think about that technology trying to replace that role of Eye of Providence in terms of what we've talked about with the religious implications?
Yeah, no, you're right. There's other sites too, like Church of Google, that gives 13 or so proofs for why Google is God. You know, that it answers all prayers, it knows all.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, there is that. I don't know. I think, and I don't think people are sheeple. I think everyone has, you know, agency and awareness, and I think that there is a sense that this kind of perverse comfort that comes from having the thing, the machine, that know you, that in a way, and this has been written about in some of the scholarship, that we are engaged in the work of being watched. So we are being paid, in a sense, not maybe monetarily, but we're being rewarded or incentivized to be exhibitionists. The more that we share, the more that we get in some incentive, whether that be ad messages that are targeted to us or these sorts of things. And the argument goes that, you know, why live in a world like we did 20 years ago, 10 years ago, where I get bombarded with all this information that's not relevant to me. Now that marketers know who I am, they can speak to me in a much more direct and intimate way and tell me things and offer me things that are useful to me. In that sense, I think people find a certain, like I said, kind of a perverse comfort in that, okay, well, I'll give that up so that I can have these other benefits. But in terms of the religious connection, that's where I have more anxiety in terms of the kind of cultural shift and drift that we're undergoing. Because I just saw Gravity last weekend, and I was talking to someone at this movie with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney, and they're stuck in space, and they have to essentially rely on all of these technological solutions to even attempt to get back home. There's a scene in which the space debris is knocking out all these satellites, and George Clooney says, "Well, half the planet just lost their Facebook," and I think it was an intentional move by the writer or director to say that, in some sense, this being stuck in space, kind of rudderless and detached from materiality, is a metaphor for our technological condition, our digital conditioning, where we spend so much time in the cyber that the material world starts to fade, and it's sort of there in the background, just as in the movie, this big, beautiful planet Earth is in the background. And I don't want to spoil the movie, but I'm going to have to make my point.
So
turn the radio down if you don't want to know. But when she makes it back to Earth on the escape pod and she lands in the water, there's this very, I mean, spiritual kind of imagery in which the water rushes into the pod, and it's almost like a baptism or rebirth. She crawls onto the shore and grabs the sand and just says thank you, the sort of prayer to the earth or to God. And it's because she's reconnected with her own body, which was kind of weightless and in space, and now she feels again the gravity of being a human, of being connected to the natural world, the material world.
And the clay.
In the clay. Oh, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you could do a whole dissertation on this. And when you look at when she's in the pods themselves, one has an icon of St. Christopher, another one has a Buddha. When George Clooney floats off into space, the last thing he says is how beautiful the light on the Ganges is. So there's all these little kind of religious spiritual hints combined with this very technological experience of being in space. Anyway, so I love the movie, and I think to make this longer story a little longer, I think it speaks to the themes in the book and the question you ask, which is these two things, our spirituality and our dependence on technology is sort of this saving force, this salvation, are so intertwined that there's some confusion, I guess you could say, and so that awareness, hopefully we can hold on to that awareness.
Well, for you, like, how do you navigate that confusion, particularly when you're working with people who are largely going to go on, if things work out for them, to be making decisions, you know, sometimes very fraught decisions, sometimes probably, you know, not very progressive ones, but, you know, hopefully there's other zones of possibility that keep things from getting, you know, too out of control. How do you sort of navigate your own ambivalence as you're sort of trying to get people, you know, move them forward in the profession, move them forward into being, you know, part of the process in a way?
Yeah, I mean, again, I try to emphasize through some of these readings that inform the course, you know, this critical reflection as being essential to the process. But also I hold out this faint hope that, like every other technology that's come before, that the imposing and seemingly overwhelming force and presence of the new technology eventually kind of fades. And that's a double-edged sword. I mean, you know, we don't talk about the effect of the telephone anymore, right? Somehow the telephone's going to disrupt social interactions to the point that no one's going to talk to each other in person anymore. They're just going to call each other. And one could argue that smartphones have amplified that or whatever, but we don't generally have an anxiety about having a phone in our house or a television. So I have this faint hope that with time, that reasonable human beings who are made in the image and likeness of God and who have that God-shaped hole in their soul aren't, at an essential level, ever going to lose that sense. And the technologies will, rather than us really adapt to them, that they sort of adapt to the environment we create for them. So that's more of a longer view of things. In terms of the students that are with me now and the message I give, it's, you know, it's that that this critical reflection is essential to whatever they do. And that's not just business. I have four kids now, and I think one of the best kind of therapies or exercises in reflecting on the effects of these things on the human person is to have children, because now all of a sudden it's not just about me. I'm responsible for these other human beings, and I'm noticing if I put them in front of a television or a device, a change in behavior and a certain lack of empathy that follows. And so I tend to observe these things very keenly. It's because it's what I do academically, but also because I'm a concerned parent. And I think other parents may feel that way too. And so I think that's another way in which we can kind of revisit or hold on to that critical awareness.
So it's like you're trying to make to keep space open there. It must be very intense. I don't have kids. To watch the sort of processes by which people are drawn in, or kids are drawn into these things at a younger and younger age, and then
it's
feeling
terrible.
Ambivalence around it. But it's also where reality is happening. So, I mean, you guys both have kids. It must be a very strange sort of science fictional situation in some ways.
It's terrifying, Maja. I don't know how you've dealt with it, but
well, my girls are 8 and 6, and I completely kept them off of devices until my younger sister moved in, and she has an 11-year-old daughter that's on the darn things all day. So they see her on it and want to do it and use it, and I see them, and they just get totally, like, it's obsessive compulsive. It's like a possession, you know.
It is like a possession, and we didn't have a television until last year. My kids are 8 and 5 and 3 and a baby. But the reason I bought the television is because, and we didn't have cell phones either, but then we had to make these sort of strategic decisions about, okay, well, you're pregnant and I'm at work. How are you going to reach me if I'm not in my office? Okay, I'll carry a cell phone. And then you go down this slippery slope. And now the kids get a hold of the cell phone and they do, you know, and then I started noticing, okay, their media habits are very individualistic, right? It's a private experience, and they're blocking the rest of the world out. There's no empathy. So in this weird kind of perverted solution, I said, okay, a television, at least it's communal. It's electronic, so it'll satisfy that need. They're only going to get, you know, 20 minutes a day or just on the weekends or however we end up doing it. But at least they'll be together, and at least we can, as a family, watch something, talk about it, and which you weren't doing when you had these personalized devices. So
that's fascinating. That's a really, really interesting move. I hope you actually write about that. That's actually I haven't heard quite that twist. Yeah, the old hearth effect of the television as a kind of saving grace in the era of personal devices. But we're gonna have to wind it up here, Brett. I want to let you. Is there any place online people can find out about you, other papers you've done?
It'd be hard to share all the URLs, but it's mostly on this book and these same themes. There's an op-ed in the LA Times and some stuff in Wired that were excerpted. And,
oh, great.
There's also an essay I did for Marginalia, which is kind of an up-and-coming review of religion and culture. Look that up. If you look up anything from this talk, the Marginalia essay is great, and the Marginalia site is great. They're partnering with LA Review of Books, and they have a lot of interesting stuff going on there. But, so that's a place to start. And Eric, you're very prescient, because the next thing I want to do is talk about children and media, because I think when we talk about consciousness and cultural consciousness, that if we want to kind of turn the tide or stem the tide, it's in our children. I think we're kind of past due in terms of being able to change things. So we're pretty hardwired. But thank you guys very much. This has been fantastic.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thanks, Brett. And from Maj and me to all you out there, keep your minds open.